Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 19th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is Dave Crow. Today's session number is CRD 2001-04, and it's titled The Laws of Jonte. Let's listen in.
Thank you for showing up today. This is the fourth in a series of sessions on the strange country of Norway as seen through the eyes of us strange North Americans. And the theme that we've been dealing with for the most part each day, we'll be embroidering on it today, is the differences in faith experiences, spiritual experiences, and the way those things get expressed in the culture at large. To be frank about it, what we've been talking about, we're going to continue to talk about today, is the commitment to individualism that we've got in North America, and that's expressed through our political structure, and the commitment to community that you see in Norway as expressed through the welfare state there. And you'll get more about that today. I want to ask you a series of questions. How many of us are U.S. folks? Are there others? Maybe I should put it another way. Are there people from other countries in the room? Yeah, German, right?
German.
Okay.
I'm a citizen.
You're a citizen. Okay, then I'm going to continue to talk lazily about all of us as Americans today. So it's just easier for me because I have a small brain.
Me too.
Yeah, good. I want to ask you about your comfort level with the following policies which you encounter in Norway. First of all, if the government told you that people could use your land for hiking, leisure, camping, as long as they stayed 100 yards away from your home, are you okay with that? Anyone want to speak to that briefly?
In my neighbor's yard.
Yeah? That's fine. That's fine? Yeah, good egalitarian people. I think we're a selected group here, actually, at Holden.
The land that I own?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes, the land that you own.
Wouldn't carry any weapons.
No way.
Yeah? No way? Don't like it? Uh-uh.
As long as they're Norwegian.
Yeah. That's a very good answer.
I'd say as long as you keep your dog quiet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can interview them first.
There you go. You want to check on them first, right? Well, let me tell you, in Norway, you don't get to check on who gets to do it, and it's law. People can use your land as long as they stay 100 yards away from your home. And I think that that's an issue that would give some of us some discomfort. We've got a different sense of property rights than Norwegians do. That's the first item on my list. Yes, go ahead.
Is it possible that, too, that maybe they're more respectful of like people's land and that you might be less concerned about someone starting a fire, like at the campfire, or
yes,
something destructive to land?
Right. That's what I think what comes along with a policy like that is a sort of shared sense of responsibility for making the policy work. Yeah. Right. So I don't think people are getting abused by that policy too much. But and it's been enshrined for so many years that it's worked. Yeah, good point. Yes.
I think those of us who would go camping,
yeah,
sometimes even get a little upset if somebody goes between our campsite and another one.
Yeah, yeah.
I
think many of us are raised to have a pretty intense sense of property rights, actually.
I've mellowed out in years, but yeah, years ago I would have.
Sure.
Well, you know, here in the U.S., you take down liability.
That's
somebody
true.
On your property.
There are legal ramifications for these,
yeah,
things, aren't there? Yeah, which is also taken care of by the non-litigious Norwegian society. They think we're crazy for suing each other as often as we do. And who can argue with them? Okay, second question. Now, you're such a great student. You're so responsive, but you got to let me move along here. Second question. If the government told you that your automobile, if it were built before 1989, was a high polluter and had to be taken off the roads, even if it were, you know, your good second automobile, one you depended upon for your commute, et cetera, how would you feel about that?
Okay.
Is it okay? Good enough purpose?
As long as I have my new BMW.
Yeah, long time. BMW's been taking shots all week. You had thumbs down, sir. Excuse me. You had your thumb down a moment ago. Speak to that, please.
I just wouldn't feel uncomfortable with that. I like old driving old cars.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Even though they're
Yeah. Well, as I told you yesterday, Oslo very nearly this winter instituted exactly this ban on cars older than 1989. They just about put that ban through because they're worried about pollution in their city. Now get this one. Here's the third one, and I think it's the kicker. In Norway, when you have a new baby, you have to clear the name of that baby with the government. Yes. There's a list of approved names. And I'll tell you further. 3 years ago, a woman in a town, a small town in Norway, a Hebrew woman, wanted to name her son Gesher. And she applied for permission to do this. And the government said no on two grounds. First of all, the name sounded too foreign, and that's their language, not mine, too foreign, okay? Secondly, the name was too close to a typical Norwegian surname and would therefore likely cause confusion. The woman refused to give. She wanted to name her child Gesher. She was at first fined a few $100s. And after she remained recalcitrant, she was in fact jailed for 3 days. How many of you feel comfortable with that? yeah. We've reached the limits on individuality here, haven't we? Go ahead.
But what about, Anderson is Anders' son
of Anders.
What's the distinction of the surname and the
given name? There are many, many, many surnames in Norway that don't have a son attached to them. That isn't such a consistent practice that you'd expect that everywhere you go.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, in Bergen, in my neighborhood, about half the people were named Sætre, or in Minnesota we'd say Satri, because that it means you worked at the Setter, which was the mountainside goat herding and butter making and cheese making place. So lots of people have those names. Now back to this question of our discomfort, certainly my discomfort with this kind of intervention, government intervention in our lives, naming our children. And yet, the friends that, in amazement, I would go to my friends and I would say, is this true? I mean, can you get behind this? And virtually without exception, my friends would say to me, it's not such a bad law. It's trying to prevent, that awful teasing that happens to children later in life. It's a protection for the children.
Boy.
And this is one of those moments where I realized, my gosh, I'm really American. I went to Norway feeling as a Norwegian American that I was going kind of home, primitive, deep home, you know? And my experience would be of feeling just perfectly in touch with the kinds of things Norwegians do, and yet this was one of a few experiences we'll talk about more tomorrow, where I really felt myself to be American and felt that this was a line I wasn't quite comfortable crossing. You guys seem to be agreeing with me. Now, although I'd be happy to hear any dissent on this one, do you want an American law about bad names?
Well, I have a bad...
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not Norwegian. some friends and I have been discussing your talks over the week, and one thought we came up with was, well, one reason possibly that all of this sort of thing works in Norway is because it is so homogeneous.
That's
so the
exactly
fact that
right.
This woman was Hebrew made her a little bit off the main track of that homogeneity.
That's right.
So therefore it was acceptable.
That's right.
And I can understand that.
That's right. And what I want to talk about today, two main things. What are the strengths and weaknesses of that kind of cultural homogeneity? And what are the implications of this for something like a faith life? Let's see if we can't work that through today a little bit. What do you see, first of all, as the strengths and weaknesses of a culture that believes uniformly in almost every one of its laws, even in this kind of practice that really impinges on your individual rights?
Diversity.
That's a problem.
Of diversity.
The possibility of diversity is a problem, isn't it? Yes. Yes, absolutely. I told the story on the first day of my professor telling I'm going to tell the story in slightly more detail. It's better. It also involves the Germans, so you'll like it. A colleague of mine at the University of Bergen named Orm Overland taught at Yale University for a while, or studied at Yale University for his graduate degree. He's a very good teacher and has a couple of books here in the United States. And he said that he was one day on the way out of the library at Yale University, and there was a woman ahead of him who had a book bag with her. And as she went through one of those sort of checkpoints on her way out of the librarian said to her, "Stop, please, we have to check your bag before you go through." And she said, "What are you saying to me? You're going to stop and look in my bag? Don't you know I'm an American?" she says, with a really heavy accent, he says. And she's an American. And he made the point, you know, how long does it take for you to be an American? Is about as long as it takes you to sign up for citizenship and decide you're an American. So the story goes. Now, that isn't to say we aren't. We discriminate against new immigrants in this country and have historically, too. I'm not saying we're innocent of that. But he said, he went on to say, my professor friend, how long does it take for a person from another country moving to Norway to become a Norwegian? And his answer was, we don't know yet because it hasn't happened. Which is really interesting. So you're right, diversity isn't, and I'll tell you one other story about diversity. One of the ugliest things I saw in Norway, if the situation was as I read it, went like this. I got out of the university one day, it's raining cats and dogs, wait for the bus finally shows up, and a bunch of us pile onto the bus to get home. And last in the line of, we pile on, and the bus is full, except the aisle is at least still free, and many times we stood in the aisle. And the bus is about to pull away, and suddenly, bam, 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 on the door. There were two people who had run up in the rain and wanted to get on the bus. And the bus driver sort of shook his head. He didn't want to let them on. Lets them on. There are a couple of young Asian men. And as they get just about a third of the way down the aisle, the bus driver guns the bus so that they all fall forward and practically fall onto the floor. And I saw one of the young men, I saw them sit down and sort of speak with each other for a minute, and one of the young men actually walked forward to the bus driver and stood and talked in his ear for a minute. And as I read the situation, he was saying to the guy, "I know what you just did to me, and I don't appreciate it." That's my strong guess that that's what happened. When those two young men stood to get off the bus at a stop, he did the same thing again. He hit the brakes really hard, and they again fell. And that, on another occasion, I saw a bus refuse to pick up a young Asian woman who was running along banging, saying, "Please let me on the bus." Now, that happened to me, too, and I look pretty Norwegian. So it could be just nasty bus drivers. It could, in fact, be that we only had one racist bus driver in Bergen who I saw at work twice. Honestly, it could be. But there is a problem with diversity in the country of Norway, and so that's one problem. Strengths and weaknesses of this cultural uniformity, sameness of spirit. What else would you point to?
Well, the concern for the welfare of children has certainly got to be admirable.
There's a great strength, isn't it? Absolutely. They raise healthy children. They're determined to raise healthy children. In fact, I was speaking with a third grade teacher today who said, "You know what the strength is in the Norwegian system as you've described it?" He said, "You're teaching the kids how to play. You're teaching them to play rather than to be couch potatoes." I thought that was a really good point. Yes?
Well, this willingness to trust the person who's 100 yards away from your door on your property.
Right.
Maybe the part of it is that, well, I just know that he grew up like I did, with the same values and virtues that I did.
There's a common trust there, isn't there? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you feel it when you're in the country. I think it's real, and I think it's true. Right, go ahead.
The surprise to me when we, our family was camping in Norway, and, camping in the Midwest, the camper is always a camaraderie, and you say hello, and you share things.
Yeah.
And I really expected that kind of behavior of Norwegians being somewhat the same ethnic background as Midwesterners. And in a campground, they absolutely pay no attention to you. You could walk along next to them and say to you know, bidet to them,
yeah.
and they would just divert your eyes.
Yeah, exactly. It happened on the streets in my town. After months, they had to know we were living in the neighborhood. And I would say hello to people on the sidewalk, and the eyes would be averted, and you get nothing from them. That's just a cultural trait.
Yeah, it's kind of
interesting. It is. It's an interesting difference, isn't it? Yeah. Very interesting. Yes.
I think we can learn something from the Norwegians. My father said, if you ever have a chance to go to Norway, be in Oslo on the 17th of May.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just like our 4th of July.
Mm-hmm.
It was just amazing. The whole celebration was around children.
Mm-hmm. It
Every
is.
School was represented. I was there. Every school child waving a flag
right.
or playing an instrument.
Right.
And the king and queen were up there, and they tipped their hats to the kids as they went by with the flags. But there were no guns, there were no tanks, there were no armies. Police were there on horses to protect the children. You know, I thought, boy, if we could celebrate America
There's no show of national authority except the flag is everywhere.
Yeah, flag is everywhere.
And you know, you put on your church clothes for Sut na Mai. You go out and you eat hot dogs and you parade in the rain in your suit and tie.
No,
it's not casual in any way. It's serious business. And furthermore, in Bergen, you go downtown for the big parade, and it's lovely. And then you come back into your neighborhood, and the children all parade around the school.
Every school has, celebration.
That passionate feeling for their country.
Yeah.
No country is more nationalistic than Norway, including us, I think. Go ahead.
Well, I wonder maybe it's with diversity. I was just wondering about some angle of creativity, because to some extent, I think that that alienation or whatever, being outside of society, might be more difficult when everybody's in it together, kind of looking at things in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Less feeling of alienation. That's an interesting idea. You know, I don't know if this is related in any way, but the suicide rate in Norway is very, very high. So apparently some people feel disconnected, alienated, or maybe they're just ill and it's a whole different thing.
But it's the whole northern area anyway.
Yeah, it's a northern trait, isn't it? Yeah.
Like lack of and sunshine.
Believe me, lack of sunshine. As soon as the sun shines, you know, they all get outside on a rock and strip to their underwear.
But I think on kind of the flip side of diversity, we can talk a little bit about the downside of it, but I think one of the interesting things about Norway is the lack of income diversity
exactly.
to this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there is a lot less space between rich and poor.
Right, you simply don't see that high-end housing on the fringe of your city, and you don't see the low-end housing in the middle of your city. People are living, by and large, equal to each other, for the most part. Yep, you're absolutely right, and that's a clear and evident strength, isn't it?
Go ahead.
To me, it may be a kind of twisted human way we approach life, is that the homogeneity almost makes the social welfare state more possible, because people look at providing those kinds of deep services as we're taking care of our own.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I had friends in Norway who told me, I think it would be difficult for this kind of thing to happen. Well, I guess it happened in the 30s when the New Deal got going. But Norwegians claim that they, throughout the 70s especially, were so thoroughly propagandized by the labor government that's where they really grew to have this absolutely uniform sense that this is the right way to go. I think there's 7 or 8 main political parties in Norway, and only one of them even talks about lowering these taxes. Even talks about it. And they're thought of as the wackos, the right wing. Høyre, they're called. And there's some ugly stuff going on in Høyre. No, I think you're absolutely right about that. Yes, go ahead.
Well, comment historically, my parents were both from Switzerland, and my mom always said, well, what you don't understand in the United States is in Europe, historically, the French married the French, the Germans married the Germans, the Swiss married the Swiss, and it was always you keep those bloodlines clean.
Yeah.
And she said that was from when they owned the castles, and that's how the control was politically
Yeah.
between the warring factions.
Mm-hmm. There's a long history for these things, isn't there? Yeah, and differences that we don't quite understand, I think. Although I remember clearly as a kid in Heartland, Minnesota, that a Norwegian Lutheran deciding to marry a Catholic girl was not such a great thing. I mean, these things have traveled. But in general, I think we're better at diversity because we have to live with diversity. We have to learn to get along, in general. I mean, we have miles of improvement to go, it seems to me. But so it goes. Well, we need to talk about these things because that's what it was billed for today. And I think this is going to be an interesting insight into this question of individuality versus communal solidarity or something like that. These are the so-called Janteloven. And I'll tell you how I first became aware of them. Well, you can tell from today that my style as a teacher is to walk in and open up a problem and see what kind of discussion we get and where we can move it forward. That's simply what I expect in a classroom. And the best teachers I've had have done that, and so I'm trying in my limited way to imitate that. Well, I walk into Norwegian classrooms to try to teach American literature, and I'd open up a question. I usually start with the simple questions just to make sure people can kind of get on board, and then we move toward complexity. So maybe the first question is, well, we read a novel for today. How'd you like it? Nothing. Bright, interested people. They look sincere. They look like they're trying, you know, but they're sitting there. And, well, this character, what kinds of values do you think this character represents in the book? You know, how are they set in conflict with the values of this other character? Trying to keep it simple. Nothing. And, you know, the whole day, I say, well, I guess I'll talk for a while then, and on I'd go. And I was forced, basically, into lecturing, even though I didn't particularly want to do it. And after a couple of days of this, I'm a little mystified. I'm thinking, what, have I ceased to be a decent teacher in the state of Norway? And I'm walking out of the classroom, and a young lady walks up to me, and she says, Professor Kroll? And I said, yes. Do you know about the Janteloven, she says. I said, Janteloven? No, I have never heard of the Janteloven. And she said, we take them very seriously, and this is the reason that people have not been talking in your classroom. I said, now I'm interested. You know, tell me about this. And she told me about the Janteloven. She actually knew about them only in a kind of vague way. She had a sense that there was a series of sort of modesty laws, and she could name some of them, but she couldn't have listed all 10 of them for me. I had to go look them up. In fact, they're in my Living in Norway book. That's where I found these. And these are, in fact, the Janteloven. This happened to me more than once. I taught classes at the local technical school. I taught guest lectures in the cities of Stavanger and Tromsø. Everywhere I'd go, I'd try to start a discussion. I'd get nothing. And someone would say, have you heard of the Janteloven? These are, in fact, what these people were talking about, the Janteloven. Janteloven means the laws of Janta. And Janta is a community in Denmark. And these laws were certainly not invented, but recorded by a novelist, a 20th century novelist named Axel Sandemose, who came from the town of Janta and sort of recorded life in that town the way Sinclair Lewis recorded life in the small Minnesota town, that sort of thing. And here they are. Number one, you shall not think you are something. Two, you shall not believe you are equal to us. Three, you shall not believe you are wiser than us. Four, you shall not believe you are better than us. Five, you shall not believe that you know more than us. Six, you shall not believe that you can rise above us. Seven, you shall not believe that you are capable. Eight, you shall not laugh at us. Nine, you shall not believe that anyone cares about you. And there's a tenth. Where did I put my book? I couldn't fit it on. You shall not believe that you can teach us anything. Yeah. Now, I didn't find any Norwegians who seemed to believe that one. Every student I had, like you, avid, interested, willing, so I think what they've done is they've boiled and distilled these down to the key messages, but the key message that I kept hearing about was, don't think you're anything special, keep quiet, don't rock the boat. It's a little bit like the so-called shame societies, isn't it? Do you know about this? You know, think about Asian societies, or is it Japanese saying, isn't it? If you're the nail that sticks up, you'll be pounded down. You know, in other words, don't be the squeaky wheel. Don't call attention to yourself. Fit in, it seems to be the message. To be fair to the Norwegian students I had, as they grew to trust me and like me a little bit more, we had pretty darn good discussions. Really, they grew to adjust to that pretty well. But their initial instinct was to call upon the Janteloven as their excuse for not speaking up. Do any of you feel that you have been taught some version of this ethic yourself? Go ahead.
Yeah, when we were kids, growing up, I remember whenever we did anything, said, now don't get a big head about that.
Yeah, right, right.
Don't, and if you did anything, don't talk about whatever you do.
That's right.
You know, and it's never, if you accomplish anything, there's no praise given. You said, nice job, that was about it.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, there's a golfer named Phil Mickelson. You guys might know about him. I'm a golf fan. I love him. And he makes these fantastic shots around the green. And his name is Mickelson. Guess what, you know, his ethnic background is. He makes a shot, and the crowd cheers, and he kind of looks bashful. Aw, shucks. You know?
No, my grandma always said, yeah, don't think you're such a much, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Don't think you're such a much.
Such a much.
Yeah. Go ahead.
My dad was, you know, he didn't want to give you too much praise because he thought you'd get conceited or something.
That's right. Yeah. Limit the praise. Limit the shows of affection. That's pretty standard among Scandinavians, right? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Certainly in public. You don't.
And certainly in public, right. Yeah. Don't call attention to yourself. Yes.
Who exactly is us?
Who does what?
Who exactly is us?
Who is us? Yes. Apparently, the citizens of Jante, and you're asking a good question. Maybe we should turn to that. You know, clearly, some of these articulate what we just felt as, say, Scandinavian Americans that we were taught. And I can affirm you on this. I was taught, you know, keep quiet, don't rock the boat, obey authority, don't think you're such a hot thing. And, you know, the teasing, oh, he's looking in the mirror again to see how pretty he is, you know, that kind of thing from my dad. He really kept the lid on, you know, on your ego thing, you know. But, so that's like number one, don't think you are something. Maybe four, don't think you're better than maybe others, we should say. Well, I guess it's hard to list them out this way, but many of them carry this message. But isn't there another message up here on these items?
Well, I sit here thinking about that, and it seems to me that that attitude you described in your classes would be very destructive of creativity and inventiveness.
You would think so, wouldn't you? You would think so. You know,
I would add a little comment. I'm a Swede. I grew up 100% Swede.
This is a good thing.
I should have said that, right? I have experience with Norwegians.
Yeah.
I can recall as a kid coming home from country school, when I got my first B grade after a few C's, the response was, oh, how come you didn't get an A?
Why
don't you do better than that?
Exactly. I got that one from my mom one time. I came home, hey, they put me into fifth grade and I got really good grades. Well, that's what we expect. My parents are great. I love them. But don't some of them also speak to a kind of threatened status? Don't they speak to a feeling, you know, don't get in my face, don't bother me, don't try to change me? Mm-hmm. There's a barrier set up by some of these as well, I think. And that, you know, I didn't find Norwegian students speaking to me about, and I don't know how much it's part of the sort of character of the country. Maybe you, yeah, go ahead.
My parents came from Norway, so I
So, you know, I really didn't know much English till I started school. But, you know, I still remember the idioms, you know, mm-hmm. Storahuva, the big head.
The big head.
You know, the Brumfrey, the Kudlubukta, you know. And they have a lot of inside jokes, how they handle, you know, you shouldn't talk about your neighbor, mm-hmm. but Storahuva, you knew that was somebody that was trying to be big headed, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And those kinds of things. So those things also became inside jokes in the family, mm-hmm. you know. Didn't talk about Austin, but you said the words.
Yeah, right, right, right. Well, I'll give you two choices right now. You can we can pursue the theological angle on this, or we can hear from Garrison Keillor. Which would you rather do? That's what I thought.
I would like to ask you one thing. Did you ever see the Beta Church at Cherka, go to the Beta Churches? That movement in Norway, the house churches?
No, I never saw much of that. No.
You didn't?
No.
See, that's strong in my family over there.
Uh-huh.
The Beta House, you know.
Yeah.
They didn't go to the big church, but they went to Beta House.
Private neighborhood services?
You know, just, you know, just people of like-minded faith, you know. You can't be big about it.
Do you know what part of Norway your people were from?
Yeah, Stavanger.
Yeah, I was going to say Stavanger. Uh-huh. There's actually a reputation in Norway that that's sort of the Bible Belt of Norway down around Stavanger.
Yeah, that's the Beta House. Yeah. And that's, I still thought, was very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember a Norwegian saying something to me like, yeah, on a Sunday you can't even get a beer down there. Garrison Keillor, of course, is the chronic. Yeah, go ahead.
Just a quick question. You haven't get into it, but do you have any additional, like, historical context around the timing or the motivation behind around this was?
What I know about it, the reading that I've done, and the information that my colleagues at the University of Bergen told me, is that what Sandemose was doing here was basically tapping into a kind of ancient sociological trait in the Scandinavian people. It's not like it's a new thing that people have bought into or something like that, but in fact this is an expression, a listing out of values that have been common for a long, long time. As I was saying, Garrison Keillor, of course, is the chronicler of the Norwegian-American experience in Minnesota, though he's neither Norwegian nor Lutheran. Did you know that? And in some of his stories, you pick up this impulse that we've been talking about, particularly the ones in which an autobiographical little boy, who you can tell is going to grow into a radio personality or some other performer, thinks about how much he wishes he could get away from his closed-down little home in Minnesota and move to New York, where the Flambeau family lives. Remember the stories about the Flambeau family? They make martinis in the evening, and they talk about going to the theater and that sort of thing. And he likes the Flambeaus. It's an alternative sort of self for this kid, and the one that, in fact, he did work towards. Hilariously funny. But it, along with one of the Flambeau stories, Keillor appends a kind of a hilarious set of footnotes. They run all through this story, a footnote on every page, some of them taking up at least half of the page. And what they are is the 95 theses written down by a person who had moved away from the small community and was ticked about the way he had been raised and had written these 95 theses. And I'm only going to read the first paragraph and the first nine of the 95, okay? That sound modest enough? And I think two others, just to give you a flavor of how Keillor thinks this stuff gets expressed in the U.S. I've given you enough background for it. Here are the 95 theses then. Number one, you have fed me wretched food, vegetables boiled to extinction, fistfuls of white sugar, slabs of fat, mucousy casseroles made with globs of cream of mushroom, until it's amazing my heart still beats. Food is not fuel but ballast. We ate and then we sank like rocks. Every Sunday, everyone got stoned on dinner except the women who cooked it and thereby lost their appetites. The rest of us did our duty and ate ourselves into a gaseous stupor and sat around in a trance and mumbled like a bunch of beef heads. Number two, every Advent, we entered the purgatory of lutefisk, a repulsive, gelatinous, fish-like dish that tasted of soap and gave off an odor that would gag a goat. We did this in honor of Norwegian ancestors, much as if the survivors of a famine might celebrate their deliverance by feasting on elm bark. Number three. You know how the Norwegians say that lutefisk was invented? They said that, you know, the ashes from a fire fell onto fish and caused the lye reaction. I don't believe it, but... Number three, you have subjected me to endless boring talk about weather, regularity, back problems, and whether something happened in 1938 or 1939, insisting that I sit quietly and listen to every word. How's it going with you, you said. Oh, about the same, you replied. Cold enough for you? It was always cold, always about the same. Number four, you taught me to worship a God who is like you, who shares your thinking exactly, who is going to slap me one if I don't straighten out fast. I am very uneasy every Sunday, which is cloudy and deathly still and filled with silent accusing whispers. Number five, you have taught me to feel shame and disgust about my own body so that I am afraid to clear my throat or blow my nose. Even now I run water in the sink when I go to the bathroom. Go to the bathroom is a term you taught me to use. Number six, you have taught me the fear of becoming lost, which has killed the pleasure of curiosity and discovery. In strange cities, I memorize streets and always know exactly where I am. Amid scenes of great splendor, I review the route back to the hotel. Number seven, you have taught me to fear strangers and their illicit designs, robbing me of easy companionship, making me a very suspicious friend. Even among those I know well, I continue to worry. What do they really mean by liking me? Number eight, you have taught me to value a good night's sleep over all else, including adventures of love and friendship. And even when the night is charged with magic, to be sure to get to bed. If God had not meant everyone to be in bed by 10:30, he would never have provided the 10 o'clock newscast. Number nine, you taught me to be nice. I think this one is really in keeping. You taught me to be nice, so that now I am so full of niceness, I have no sense of right and wrong, no outrage, no passion. If you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all, you said. So I am very quiet, which most people think is politeness. I call it repression. And two others. In place of true contrition, you taught me to be apologetic. I apologize continually. I apologize for my own existence, a fact that I cannot change. For years you told me I'd be sorry someday. I am. And finally, number 17. Listening to my elders, I was taught to keep quiet. Stupidity had the floor always. Argument was impolite. That one rings true to me. Argument was just not allowed. It isn't allowed in family gatherings where I come from. It's probably a good thing since half of us are Democrats and half are Republicans. But reaction to those, do they ring true?
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, you betcha.
Yeah, sure. Oofta. Yeah, go ahead, Sarah.
Well, one of the things that I hear Chris and Keeler say quite often, when, especially when referring to Minnesota weather or something, is, you know, it's been sunny for 5 days.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, okay, we're ready now for the other shoe to drop.
Yeah.
It's that feeling that, you know, we don't deserve a sunny day. We don't deserve anything good to happen.
Yeah.
And beware, the shoe will drop.
Yeah. So, you know, so where's the joy? Where's the passion? Where's the hope?
Also, the you shall not, the negative, I mean, the rules against rather than pursuing the
right.
ultimates.
Right, the very rhetoric of these things bespeaks a kind of repressive cultural attitude, doesn't it? Go ahead.
Could that have anything to do with the high suicide rate?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to explain something as complex as that. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, possibly so. Sure. Go ahead.
I was raised in a half Scandinavian or Norwegian community, and laughter. I mean, you could listen to the you could go to a play, a high school class play, and the kids would laugh mm-hmm. because something was funny. Mm-hmm. But the guy would, you know, almost he'd have to almost hold his hand over his mouth to keep from laughing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you're getting to the to what I was going to work toward in terms of some kind of faint theological connection here. Isn't what you just spoke about a kind of Haugian seriousness, a moral seriousness? And I wonder, in fact, if the laws of Janta don't have roots in some ways in Lutheran theology, which speaks, or Protestant theology, which speaks of our sinfulness, of our falling away from God, of our need for help. It's a curious ethic, I think. Please help me with this. Now I'm floundering and I'm looking.
I got a question about that.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm full-blooded Norwegian, yeah. And all, of course, there's all the relatives are too, and in this Norwegian community. And there were, all of those things ring true, but there was I realize now, an incredible silent acceptance of wayward people.
Yeah.
The girl who got pregnant out of wedlock.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking about serious stuff. Incest in the family and the farm that was out there 10 miles. And nobody went around. I never heard it. And my dad verifies that it wasn't talked about. Did you hear about it? And it was kind of, yeah, we know that. And so there's kind of a grace in the midst of all this.
There is.
And it's more of a question than it is an observation.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very, very good point. I'm not sure I would have thought to make that point, but I think it's very true. There's a moment where I get kind of frustrated with my little hometown. I think under force of different pressures, I've become such a different person than most of the people living there. But boy, I love being around there when the rubber hits the road. I'm thinking particularly of funerals. The community comes together in this incredible solidarity and this feeling of support, of mutual support, and of just faithfulness. You know, thank you. There were other people who wanted. Yes.
Well, in my father's my grandmother came from Norway. My grandma and grandpa. But they were very serious people. But you knew they cared about you. Mm-hmm. And I think that there was an intense private, you know, family privacy, and then also caring and taking care of your family. You didn't, if there's an illegitimate child, you raise that child in the family. Mm-hmm. My grandmother raised one, and you know, cousin, and it, you didn't, it was nothing that anybody apologized for. Everybody mm-hmm. just kept to themselves and took care of things, mm-hmm. it seemed. But they're very serious.
Right. Oh, yeah. I didn't mean to denigrate moral seriousness. I kind of believe in it, actually, myself. Yeah. My mother's family raised an orphan kid, too.
Yeah. Well, another thing that I was keep thinking about, the identity thing, because I was volunteering over at the Nordic Museum in Dalar, and so we were serving a dinner, and when I first started, the first thing that nobody would talk to me until they asked me, the first thing they wanted to know was which was I? Was I Norwegian, Swedish, Danish, what, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I told them. So she brought me an apron that said Norway on it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you wore an apron that had the right identity. Mm. And then you were okay.
Really?
But they had to put you in a place, you know? Mm. Mm. It was just a little interesting. Mm.
It is. You're next.
Where does that strong sense of pride come from? You know, I have some Norwegian blood in my family, and they're so proud of that. It's just like the colors, everything they are. What's the basis for that? Is it the homogeneity or?
I don't know. I think I feel that pride, actually. And it carries over to other choices, and you feel proud that you went to Luther, as I did, you know, for instance. Now you feel that way about your schools, too. There's an intense pride about that. And I think that pride got carried across the sea from Norway. As I said, it's, you know, the romantic movement of nationalism was so strong in Norway That's one suspicion I have, but others may want to speak to that too. Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to ask the Norwegians here. I worked for a number of years at Scandinavian Airlines and we were dealing with why the Norwegians, the recent ones, earlier immigrants to this country came because of, I guess, maybe, no land, But the more recent ones, is there a tendency for those folks who cannot tolerate this disciplined setting to leave and come over here?
I don't know of, there's very little emigration away from Norway these days. And I can only try to assure you, this is a gut sense I have, I just felt almost no dissent when I was in Norway from people generally about any part of their culture. The welfare state, the cultural attitudes, there's very little dissent. People are satisfied with who they are for the most part. Go ahead.
You were living in growing up in a Norwegian community in Western Minnesota, but living in Spring Grove, which was ultimately Norwegian. There were three things: faith, family, and fun. Yeah. It was a rollicking, great fun.
Yeah.
Laughing at themselves.
Yeah.
Ollie and Lena were very popular.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And I never, it was always a comfortable support, but the community support when there was a death or...
I think there's something really healthy about this. In other words, I always feel that Norwegians who have such intense national pride, that's a danger, isn't it? But they temper the national pride with a sense of personal modesty, which was really attractive, really nice to be around. I haven't forgotten.
Go ahead. What I was thinking is, I grew up in a family where my father was Swedish, Finn, and my mother was Dutch. And the one funny thing that happened in Swedish Finn families, if you have people over for coffee, they say, oh, please come to the table and have some, cake and coffee. And then they say, oh, but we mustn't. And then this would go back and forth. And then in my mother's family, that didn't happen. So my dad was over at the in-laws or whatever, and they said, oh, have some coffee. And he said, oh, no, but I mustn't. So he didn't get any.
They took him out of the room.
It's hard to live in, because I didn't know which tradition to follow. When my mother was alive, she was kind of running the show, and now she's gone, and now I'm kind of getting the flavor of my dad's side.
I have colleagues in the English department at Augustana who speak of a problem that I don't think Paul and I have. And they say, God, this whole Swedish thing, how do you get it figured out? How can you ever tell what people really mean when they say something? I don't have a bit of problem with that, do you, Paul? I pretty much know what's going on. At least I carry that illusion. They seem to feel some problem with that. Yeah.
But so the Norwegians don't behave that way.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to try not to speak. You folks keep carrying the ball. Go ahead.
I'm really struck. I have very little, except for having read a lot of Garrison Keillor and having some Swedish in-law. I have very little perspective, but what I'm really struck by is the similarities with Japanese culture.
Mm-hmm.
I teach at a university that has a large number of Japanese exchange students. And so when that relationship took a big step and there were going to be a lot more students that we would be interacting with, there were some seminars on how to understand Japanese culture. And some of the things, one thing that you just said, but I'll get back to that. If you go into class, because we're used to having an interactive classroom, the students will not volunteer. They will sit there like a stone. They will be very attentive, very respectful.
Mm-hmm.
They will listen to everything you say, but they will not volunteer. Do not single out a Japanese student, because this is a cause for shame and embarrassment.
Right.
Apologizing, to that thing too. I forgot. What was the thing that was just said?
The indirection in speech.
Oh, indirection.
Yeah.
The line is that there are 42 ways or something like that to say no in Japanese.
Uh-huh.
None of them involve the word no.
Uh-huh. Oh,
that would be be very difficult. That means no.
Yeah.
You just don't know it yet. So you say, oh, it's okay, I can work it out. No, it would be really difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just really struck by some of the similarities there.
Yeah. Here's another expression of it that I saw, and it's one of the best pieces of evidence I have. As most of you know, in the U.S., when you undertake college level or university level study, you're asked to, at least in the better situations, you're asked to tell the professor back on an exam or a paper, at least show that you've been in the class and show that you've taken in some of the information given. But there's a sense in which you're also supposed to put your own spin on it, aren't you? You're supposed to show something like personal growth. You're supposed to advance the thing a bit, if you can, in your own direction. In Norway, I saw almost none of that. Your job, you sit down at the end of the term and you take this mother of all 6-hour long exam, sometimes 8 hours. And your job basically is to show that you've taken very careful notes in the lectures. So you know, that individual spin is not called for.
Hey,
yeah.
What I find so fascinating with this is that usually in a welfare state, there'd be a tendency for people to want more and more, so it becomes unaffordable.
Yeah.
But yet, maybe these laws just keep everything so that they're very good stewards.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's one of the healthy aspects of this thing, isn't it? The great contentment with which they drive old cars and just keep fixing them up, because they can't afford the incredible taxes on a new one, and then paying the $6 gas, and they do it, you know, with contentment because they know they're building the kind of society they want to build. There is, you know, in other words, what they're, and this is related to an Asian culture, they're willing to diminish personal wishes in favor of the broader community. Yeah. And I think, frankly, Americans tend to be pretty bad at that. Churches sometimes do better, you know, it seems to me, but our most exploitive politics, it seems to me, says be an individual and forget about other people.
Did you see any junk cars?
No, I don't recall seeing. No, no.
You just don't see it.
Well, you know, one reason why when you buy an automobile, new or used, you pay a healthy disposal fee on it. So when you're done driving the car, that money is used to dispose of it properly.
Never saw a church.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned yesterday that only 3% go to church. Is Lutheran Church still a state church?
Yes, it is.
And since only 3% go, I wonder if there's any talk about getting rid of that state church, since it's not a value to very many.
The Swedes are working on making congregations independent of the state, but Norwegians are not, to my knowledge. But I have an answer to that. On the first day that we met, I noted that the same government agency that builds churches and hires pastors also builds schools and hires teachers. And under pressure, that arm of the government will almost always build a school and hire teachers rather than building a church and hiring a pastor. But by the same token, when a church is built, it's only sporadically a worship center. It's kind of like our center next door. It's mostly a civic center. It's shared by the community. Community gatherings happen there. And I think maybe that's one reason that they're content to allow the state to continue to control the church, is because it really is sort of made useful for everyone, even if they're not worshipers. Yeah. Other comments, questions? Go ahead.
Well, I'm all Norwegian. I grew up with that kind of worm theology, you know, the simple stuff and all that. But we'd go visit my mother's family were immigrants, and they were the only Norwegian family in a mining community in northern Wisconsin. But I had this sense of envy that they had over the Italians around them, because the Catholics had a lot of fun. They just seemed a lot more expressive and you know, drank a lot of wine and
right.
Completely different.
I was so shocked when I went. I go to these Lutheran faculty meetings in the summer times occasionally. And I was so shocked when I went to Capital University, which has a German heritage, if I remember right. And the first night we get there, they wheel a keg into the cafeteria. And we all stood around and drank beer. And I'm thinking, at Luther College, I mean, this is not going to happen. That's right, cultural envy. Go ahead.
It seems that maybe one of the interesting differences between the North American culture and the Norwegian culture are that one of the struggles I think we have is that we can't separate individualism and self-worth from pride and selfishness that leads to, or that we perceive that it can lead to.
Yeah.
And that maybe in trying to prevent the pride and selfishness, they downplay the seed of that, which might be individualism and self-worth.
Right. I'm guilty of that myself because I want a bigger house right now. You know, I think we're just crowded as heck in my house. And right, you know, in Norway, what you feel proud about, what you'd feel shame about, you'd feel shame if you had a much better home than your neighbor. I mean, it's not just me saying that. That's in the literature. It's a cultural value. Someone over here had a hand up. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking about the time I was starting high school, we moved into a community that was mostly Italian. Mm-hmm. So I ran around with Italian kids all through high school. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things that happened, kids stuck together and they go to somebody's house and eat. And I said, no, thank you. And I got told immediately that I was insulting the person who made the food and that I should never turn down food in an Italian house.
So. Yeah.
And there's a different way of, that's a different kind of politeness.
We were taught some of that stuff too, actually, in Norway. You take a small serving the first time because you're expected to say, to take seconds. You really must take seconds, and you don't turn down the dessert.
I want to say something about the beer. The beer in Germany is brewed, the best beer is brewed by Bavarians, which are Catholics.
Yeah.
They have 900 breweries in that small country.
Yeah. And God love them.
That's right. Yeah. Even to the babies, you speak well.
Yeah. I cannot affirm that.
There were a couple laws in Norway when I was there in the mid-80s that I'm wondering if are still around.
Yeah.
One is that families get a stipend for having children because the government wants to increase population.
Yes, you do.
And the other is that every worker, and I'm not sure how they define worker, is entitled to access to a window.
Yeah, I think that is true, actually. That's right. I hadn't thought about that one for a long time, but the stipend for children is interesting. It's worth almost $10,000 to you to have a kid in Norway, and you know, it has become so common for families to have only one child. They're really trying to get families to have more than one child. And furthermore, the Bondevik government, run by this Lutheran minister, prime minister, initiated a program to try to keep more children at home instead of in daycare. So you'd get a further stipend if you committed to keeping your child at home instead of in daycare. Except what the Norwegians are doing is taking the stipend and going to black market daycare providers that aren't reporting to the government. So they're getting both the stipend and the daycare. But again, child-centered laws, and you probably know about this one. Each time you have a child in Norway, one of the parents receives a full year off, paid, full paid, and the other parent, this is more recent, the other parent also gets a month off. And the typical way to use that is the mother takes the year off to be with the baby for the first year, and the father takes that additional month. So they get 13 months of the children before they go to daycare.
Mm-hmm. Just to follow up on that a little bit, I teach in a college, and of course I taught last year was in labor studies, and we had the head of the Norwegian youth party come and speak to us, and she talked about how the labor party, from her perspective, is moving more towards the right and wanting to reduce the social services in Norway. Mm-hmm.
It is the youth wing that's forcing, that's urging that these things be kept in place. Now, I don't know what it is about the Labour Party that's moving away from these services. Maybe they're finding they're hard to afford. I don't know. And even in the oil state. I don't know. I think we're about out of time unless anyone else has just something else they're dying to get in here. Okay.
I have one question for those in the Midwest. Someone mentioned how proud we are to be Norwegian, and I guess my grandparents were from Norway, but as I ask kids in school, what's your heritage? The kids nowadays have no clue.
Yeah.
You know, we knew right away. I'm Norwegian and Italians, and when we grew up, it was the Italian section and the Greek section and so on. But the kids today have none of that.
Yeah.
And in Norway, I mean, that's all they got.
It's diminishing, isn't it? Yeah. I ask my college kids the same thing. At Christmas time, I say, how many of you have to eat all kinds of odd foods because you got an ethnic connection at Christmas time? Very few of them now raise their hands. These kids are mostly coming from the western rim of Chicago, the Chicago suburbs, and Rockford, places like that, to Augustana. And it is diminishing. But expand on what you just said, but that's what the Norwegians really have, or it's the only thing they have?
Well, they, you know, they'll have that continually because that's, they don't have the diversity that we have here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say, well, where were your grandparents from? Mm-hmm. Well, they're from Chicago. Well, where were they? And they don't know. They have no idea.
They're doing what we do, aren't they? They're balancing priorities and trying to make it work. I mean, they feel so strongly that they've got the best country in the world going there and that they've done things right. But they're worried that if they let too many people in and share in this thing, that the whole thing is going to change. Norwegians won't be Norwegians anymore. And the state won't be the same state anymore. And that's, well, we wrestle with the same thing, don't we? How many Mexicans can come across the border?
I just want to mention that for the Norwegians, there's a very good Norwegian store in Ballard.
In Bard?
And on 15 yeah. Mile Road, and it's very good.
Yeah?
They have all those odd things, you know.
Yeah, it's one of the great things about being American. You get this divided heart. You get right. both things. Go ahead.
I have a story to tell. I grew up in a very Norwegian community in central Minnesota. And when we were little kids, my dad told us, well, my mom was half Norwegian and half a mixture. But I was told, all of us kids were told that we were Norwegian, and don't you ever forget.
Yeah.
So all these years I believed I was all Norwegian.
Yeah.
So then six years ago, in fact, we were out here in Seattle visiting a second cousin of mine, and there happens to be some mental illness in their family, and they were told that it's hereditary, so they were trying to do some research. And they traced my grandfather and found out that, he left my grandmother, who was Norwegian, when she had five little kids.
Mm.
And my dad was the oldest, and he was 9 years old. Well, we always thought he was really a rotten guy for doing that, you know, kind of a good for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's kind of what we were told, not by my dad, but, you know, we just heard that. So come to find out, when this cousin of mine had done this research, he said the birth certificate of his grandmother, who was my dad's sister, said the mother was Louisa May Anderson, born in Norway, and the dad was August Anderson, born in Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I can't believe that. I just can't believe that.
I have a strong suspicion that in a lot of mixed families, if there's Norwegian blood and some other blood, that the identity in the family is going to be Norwegian, because there is this strong sense of nationalism. I think that happens pretty commonly. Now, I'm sorry, we're out of time. I'll speak with you personally about this. We're out of time. I'm going to have to let everybody go so you can get to dinner. So thank you very much.
The community that I grew up in.